jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
This is the Hagman and Hagman Report for today. It is Friday, October 2nd, 2015. We're coming to you live from the radio and television studios of the Hagman and Hagman Report, located here in beautiful but rainy, cold, chilly northwest Pennsylvania at our regular time, 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, the real time, as we do every Monday through Friday. We're very proud to be broadcasting on the Global Star Radio Network and featured live and in high-def video on YouTube. That's right, our own special official channel on the YouTube network. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Is there a fire? Is there an emergency? What happened? I just saw our studio people just ran. Joe ran and our tech ran. Is there a bomb threat? No one told me. What's going on? All right. Okay. Wow. Okay, where was I here? Well, I'm Doug Hagman at the helm with fellow investigator researcher, most importantly, my son Joe Hagman. Wherever he is, he's probably strapping on the Kevlar as I sit here waiting to get shrapnel. Together, we are the Hagman and Hagman Report, what I like to call America's premier father-son investigative team. It's our job to bring you the news that propels the headlines and the guests to do just that. And, of course, we will tonight. John Little from OmegaShock.com. He's coming on tonight to make some sense of the headlines and to put everything in perspective, talk about the Illuminati-controlled mass media, the Illuminati themselves, and the power brokers behind the power. And that's what we're doing. So, Joe, welcome back to the booth. I saw you run out, and all I saw were legs and elbows. And was there a bomb threat?
No.
Somebody calling a bomb threat?
We just wanted to make sure that the audio on Blog Talk was streaming live without issue, and it is.
Well,
and just to let people know who listen, Blog Talk Radio is the platform we had before we came to Global Star. And we use that as a secondary platform. And the interactive chat room is open there. And the show is live there also for people who prefer that, as we have gotten some emails of people who didn't like the change. But just for you, it's back up there. Thank you, Eric.
It's everyone. It happens, right?
Great show for tonight.
Yeah, John Little. Before we go any further, Joe, hang on a second here. Let me just see something.
Folks, let me explain this. We are in our new studio.
Yes,
and
we are.
We will not be on video tonight, but we will be doing video. And we have a number of images we're going to be playing with. And now you'll start to see images of our new studio. What you see are the projectors behind us. On Monday, those will be up and running. And I think you guys are going to be pleasantly surprised, as I was.
You know what I just did here?
These things are high tech.
Okay, Eric, I just screwed
makes
up
us,
here.
Makes us look very professional.
How do I get out of that? I double click that, and I shouldn't have. Oh, up there. That's right. Okay. All right. Yeah, I'm so
still
sorry.
Still getting
folks.
Used to it, too. Yeah. We have a new operating system. And,
if what we can do, here's our tech, Eric, and he is actually, what you see there is. For those people watching live on YouTube, that's the that's the third finished. You see our tech there working hard, looking at
the delay on YouTube is pretty significant, so it still hasn't popped up.
And what this is the of course today we put up the. I mean, we didn't do anything unless Eric's pregnant. We didn't do anything. Eric did all this work putting up the we have miles of cable and miles of things going on. Oh, there it is. I can look over there and see it. Okay, and monitors everywhere. There's another image of Eric working hard, the different camera views. And what you see on there is the background.
Do you have an image with the images on the back projector?
Well, yeah, I mean, this kind of is, so to speak, I suppose. Oh, wait, I have to press it. I got to push it over. You mean like a motion?
Well, I don't know. We had we have all these options from skylines of cities to mountain ranges to
well, there it is right there. I mean
they could see the projectors. I just didn't know if you had a picture with an image with the actual projectors running, but that's okay.
No, you guys will.
Well,
this
is awesome.
This is it. But we intend to use this not for aesthetics, but for information. And see that's the whole big thing. I mean, that's the big thing about this. All right, now we've wasted enough of your time. Okay. Hang on. Hey, Eric.
Come on.
Can you come here for a second?
I just wanted to show you something. We have Mr. John Little. OmegaShock.com is his website. OmegaShock.com. And that is Eric in the pictures there. He's the one who made all this possible, did all the wiring. He's the sound guy over here and put this all together.
Yeah, exactly.
Couldn't have done it without him. So,
we intend to address the shooting, by the way, in Oregon. We intend to address that, just not tonight. I mean, talk to me, bro. Hit that. All right, and then we do this, right? Okay. All right, so we just changed the picture. All right, but we're gonna talk about the shooting that took place and what the agenda is behind it. Maybe John Little will talk about this as well.
And what's going on in Syria, too.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, we called that. The regular listeners to this show have understood exactly what's going on in Syria. Now Russia has declared a no-fly zone. This is what wars – this is exactly how wars start, and – there it is, you know. I mean, so it's very serious. Domestically, it's serious. Geopolitically, it's serious. It's extremely serious all across the board. All right. Next week.
We got a lot of stuff going on next week. Monday, you have a possible guest set up.
Yeah, well, there's an evolving situation. I'm sorry, Joe. There's an evolving situation going on with a family in California. J.B. Wells talked about it, and hopefully we'll get we'll see if we can get the attorney on.
Tuesday, Daniel Holdings and Stan Deo will be on. Daniel Holdings, first 2 hours. Stan Deo, hour number three. Wednesday, Dr. Michael Lake will be our guest.
No.
Thursday,
Dr. Michael Lake. And then Wednesday, Steve Quayle and Steve Rocco.
And Steve Rocco.
Right.
And also Tom Horn and a few others are lined up without dates, but either the end of next week or the beginning of the following week.
Exactly. So...
But tonight,
all right.
Tonight we have Mr. John Little. Again, his website is OmegaShock.com.
And what you'll see, folks, on the screen are just different, really from 0 to 60, from frame to completion of the studio, which is not yet 100% complete. So go ahead, sir.
And Mr. Little is in Taiwan, so it's Saturday morning where he is, very early, and we want to thank him for. Spending his time with us and being here, because last time he was on, we had a fantastic show, awesome feedback, a great amount of feedback. John, you're very well liked. You got I don't think we sent you any of the emails, but we got tons of them, and we got just as many asking to get you back on, and we are blessed to have you on with us tonight. How are you doing?
Well, it's an honor to be on the show. In fact, I don't know what to say. I need to be able to say all this to my wife so I can tell her how everybody likes what I've been saying, or may not like. I don't know. But, yeah, it's interesting. It's a beautiful morning here in Taiwan. The skies are almost completely clear, which is a little unusual. And the typhoon that went through was quite something. So... I kind of enjoy those, although they aren't always so great, especially the aftermath. But anyway, yeah, we have a lot to talk about, interesting things that are happening, and all I can say is there isn't a huge amount of good news out there, and I wish it was the other way around. It's certainly not something that I enjoy to be able to talk about so much gloom and doom. When really, I would love to talk about how great everything is. So I guess we need to probably talk a little bit about Syria since we talked when since we mentioned it.
Yeah, lots happening in Syria right now. We have a convergence of powerhouse nations throwing themselves in the ring of this civil war started by us Americans, the American government, and now
to a large extent, yeah,
yeah. You know, we've been overthrowing governments in the Middle East for decades now, and you know, the collateral damage. And to hear the president speak today about Syria, saying, you know, he's doing what the Syrian people want, the will of the Syrian people, I find that hard to believe when half of them have had to flee, a large number have been, you know, massacred, and the whole country is a war-torn, just chaotic wasteland right now. Just what Obama's comments, I mean, that really got me going when he said that he was, you know, behind the Syrian people and doing this for them. He literally has destroyed their nation. And
well, it's not just Obama, though.
No.
To be fair about this, we and John, I mean, you can certainly shed light on this, but this is an initiative that was started long ago. I mean, well into the late 90s, early 2000s, at least the modern iteration of it. And, of course, not just the United States, but Western nations, Western intelligence agencies, NATO, the NATO countries, and even Saudi Arabia and some Arab countries behind it as well. What do you say about that?
Well, it is a fascinating mess. It's really interesting, and it's hard to really sort of you pull on one strand of the sweater, and other strands kind of get pulled. I guess working back, I mean, it really starts with the current president's father, Hafez al-Assad. He was really the one. I mean, he started political life with a coup, overthrew the. I can't remember whether he was the king or not. But anyway, the French and the British tried to set up their own sort of Middle East system, and it collapsed in a series of coups. We had the coups in Egypt. We had the coups in Syria and in Iraq. And eventually it just all basically turned into rule by general. And Hafez Assad was the general of the Air Force. He took over Syria, and he was really a part of the Alawite minority. They were just a tiny minority living on the coast of the Mediterranean. In fact, they're still a tiny minority living on the coast of the Mediterranean. And Hafez basically appointed all Alawite generals and close family members to be in the government, and they ruled Syria from day one. I mean, they ruled from Damascus, and in fact, if you look carefully at the government building in Damascus, you'll see that it's a fortress. I mean, getting into that place is interesting. But when Hafez died, Bashar was an ophthalmologist. He was an eye doctor in Britain, and they had to kind of drag him back to Syria. I think there was an element of kicking and screaming. The interesting thing is the brother that was supposed to take over in Syria died mysteriously in a car wreck. The question is, we don't know exactly whether that was an assassination or just foolish driving. Anyway, the country is being ruled not just by Bashar, but it's also being ruled by the family and by the Alawites. And I find it interesting that when Russia kind of moved in to support Bashar, they moved into Latakia and Tartus. They didn't move into Damascus. And it's almost as if, and I don't know for sure, I mean, these are early days in terms of what they're going to be doing, but it's almost as if Russia is saying, yeah, we'll save the Alawite community in Syria, but we're not sure that we'll do much more than that. We'll let you other guys handle the heavy part. What's going on in Damascus is interesting. And they, the rebels already control one neighborhood in Damascus. In fact, they have controlled that neighborhood for the last, I think, about 2 years. And I'm very surprised that they haven't been able to dislodge the rebels from, I think it's Jobor. I'm not remembering the name exactly where they were. They shot a mortar shell at the Russian embassy, and the Russian embassy started squawking about this. So, but that was a bit of a shock for me. I mean, just to find out that the Syrian rebels are embedded in the capital of Damascus. And then when I looked at the map and I realized how far the rebels had gotten, I mean, Syria is just basically destroyed. And I really feel sorry for the Syrian people. And the thing is, the majority of the Syrians, at least as far as we have been able to understand, that majority of the Syrians do blame the United States and the Gulf Arabs for what's going on in their country. And the interesting thing is that I don't know whether it was yesterday or the day before, there was an implicit recognition by the Saudis that they were the ones that were funding and creating the rebels. I mean, I just sat there and I go, like, wait a second. You just admitted this? I mean, it's like we knew this, but you actually admitted this? For those that, just as a refresher, for those who don't really know exactly why there is this massive civil war going on in Syria, well, there's a number of reasons. I mean, but the biggest one right now is because of pipelines. We have two competing natural gas pipelines, one coming from Qatar and the other coming from, at least I think it's Qatar, it could be Oman. Yeah, too early in the morning. Anyway, the other one is coming from Iran. And it was the Iran-Iraq-Syria pipeline that was, I guess they called it the Islamic pipeline, that was actually supported by anyway, it doesn't matter. The Russian natural gas company.
Right. I want to say Gazprom.
Gazprom, exactly.
Okay.
Guys, it is 7:20 in the morning over here. I'm just telling you, okay? Brain cells aren't quite awake. So, anyway, that pipeline the negotiations were reaching completion when the civil war actually started in Syria. So unless you want to believe in coincidence, and of course we don't do coincidence theory here, we actually deal with reality, they saw that this pipeline was actually going to go through and they launched the civil war. Now, initially, of course, the excuse was, I think there were like four or five kids that were tortured by Syrian intelligence. I think this was either Homs or somewhere else. And that ostensibly was the initial reason. Of course, they could have chosen anything. I mean, look, Syrian intelligence is a pretty brutal organization. And if anyone remembers, there is a term that some of us used to use called Hama rules. Hama rules are basically the rules of massacre when you are faced with a town or a village that is resisting you. And so if you invoke Hama rules, it means basically you're going to kill everyone. And Hama is a town in northwestern Syria where Hafez Assad was faced with a revolt in a town, like a city, in which he went in and just massacred everyone. And it was his brother, Hafez's brother, I don't remember his name. He was the one that was the architect of that massacre. So there is an element of justice in some of this. Hafez was a brutal, evil guy. Did some evil, evil things. And so you might say that there's an element of a payback here. But I don't think that many of us really are wanting to see that payback. What we'd really like to see is just peace and an end to the suffering. But of course, look, when the Bible says in Isaiah 17 that Damascus is going to be taken away from being a city, and to those of you that have read Isaiah 17 and have thought that this was a moment in time in history, please note that Damascus was never destroyed. Never destroyed completely. The Assyrians went in and they burned the city, but of course rock and stone doesn't burn very well, so it was only the wood and whatever. And they occupied the city and rebuilt it. It has been continuously occupied for thousands of years, and it's, well, still there. But
and just a little, if I can.
Go ahead.
Damascus, it's always been the head of Syria. It has been inhabited since, you know, almost the beginning of time. It has been a city, and it has been, you know, a very... It was a huge population center and for thousands of years, and that has changed. And in Isaiah in 17, it starts out, "The burden of Damascus, behold, Damascus is taken away from being a city, and it shall be a ruinous heap." And it goes on to talk about what will happen. And it goes on to say, "The fortress also shall cease from Ephraim, and the kingdom from Damascus, and the remnant of Syria. They shall be the glory of the children of Israel. And that day it shall come to pass that the glory of Jacob shall be made thin, and the fatness of his flesh shall wax lean." And it goes on to explain in 17 the nations and what God is doing, and it talks about, you know, woe to the multitudes of people who are fleeing to other nations. And it is, you know, this scripture along with in Daniel where it talks about Egypt and Libya being overthrown, I think are two of the biggest prophecies, or two of prophecies we've seen or are seeing being fulfilled right in front of our eyes. And this tells us the time is short.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, when you sit down and you carefully analyze the geopolitical implications of all of that, it is shocking. I mean, the idea of Damascus actually not being a city anymore, it's hard to even understand how that is even possible, because you're seeing that you're talking about the displacement of millions of people. I mean, Damascus is more than just that little city. It's an entire area. I mean, it's just chock-a-block with people. And it's hard to believe that that would happen, but it is happening. I mean, we already have a, I guess you might say an example of this in Beirut. I mean, this is going to be worse than Beirut. I don't know. Doug, you probably remember the news about Beirut.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, I have friends that fought in Beirut. It was a mess. It was horrible. And the idea that we will see a repeat, but in this case, it will be far worse because Isaiah says so. I mean, this is going to be just a horrible situation. And part of the reason why it will be horrible is that there will be no one that will jump in with enough force and enough strength to actually achieve victory quickly. This is going to be one of those long, drawn-out, grinding conflicts where just millions of people are going to die or get displaced. And it's horrifying. And the thing is this, if you're a democracy, if you are a country that values peace and safety, and you've got something like this that's happening on your border, like United States, let's say Mexico was engaged, well, in a sense, actually is engaged, but let's say Mexico gets worse. Let's say the narco-terrorists, you know, take over in Mexico and then start fighting amongst themselves, and Mexico descends into this morass of civil war and violence. You know, is America going to sit and do nothing? They're going to have to go in and clean it up, because that violence will spill over into into the United States, and that's the situation that Israel is faced, and Jordan. But right now, Israel, Jordan, and I guess Turkey, but of course Turkey was part of what started all this, are going to be forced to go in and fix this eventually. Because I don't think Russia is going to be able to fix this. In fact, Russia is taking a slowly, softly approach, even though, yes, they are engaged in airstrikes. But you don't see much in the way of ground forces involved here. What Russia has brought into Latakia and TARDIS is basically a security team for their bases. I mean, there's not much more than that. And they've also avoided Damascus. What is those that are fighting in Damascus are the Syrian army, Hezbollah, and then we're about to see Jerusalem force. And this is the other, I guess you might say, the joker in the deck. People refer to the Iranian Special Forces group called Quds Force.
Right.
But Quds is an Arabic word in a country that speaks Farsi. Why would the Iranians use an Arabic word when they all speak Farsi? Well, the reason why is because this Arabic word is special in the Arabic language. It means the holy. Quds is the word for Jerusalem. Their top special forces group is called Jerusalem Force. Their main goal is Jerusalem. Their main goal is the destruction of Israel and the capture of Jerusalem. That is the focus of Iran. And when you have Iran engaged in Syria and getting close to the Israeli border, Israel can't sit there and just let that happen. Anytime an Iranian general, anytime any Iranian troops get close to the Israeli border, Israel immediately attempts to destroy them. And they have to. They don't have any choice. It's sort of like... go ahead.
Not to get you off track, Mr. Little, did you happen to see Benjamin Netanyahu's statement to the UN?
Yes, I did. It was impressive. 44 seconds of silence.
Did you get the impression that that Israel might be ready to act preemptively from that speech?
No. No. Okay. I think, let's put it this way. First of all, Israel has zero interest in engaging in Syria. Zero. I mean, there is no interest whatsoever.
Oh, I agree with about Syria,
But the thing is this. Look, the thing is Israel has always acted under the strategy of fighting on someone else's territory is better than fighting on your own. So if you foresee that that you're going to have to fight on your own territory, the best thing to do is to push into theirs. So that's always the first order of battle for the Israelis. The other problem is this, and this is an interesting one that most people probably don't know. The Druze are a big part of the Israeli military and are really an integral part of Israel itself. The Druze of Galilee. Now, there are the Druze of the Golan. They have sort of played a kind of half in, half out, not sure which side we're on, but we're not happy about the situation kind of approach because they're connected with the Druze in Syria. The Druze in Syria are not happy, and they're not, things aren't going well. And the Druze of Galilee are kind of like, well, wait a second, maybe we should try to help them, help the Druze of Syria. The Druze of Syria have tried to stay out of the conflict. However, they're being drawn into it. And so there is an element of a desire to by Israel to help the Druze in Syria, even though the Druze in Syria are trying to keep Israel at arm's length. But that is changing because the rebels, actually both sides, both the Syrian government and the rebels, are attempting to pull the Druze in one side or the other. So Israel possibly could be drawn into this war just to protect the Druze in Syria. It's hard to know, but this is very interesting. The Druze are sort of a wild card in this whole thing. The Druze are sort of a, in fact, I was looking into it, they're part Islamic, part Buddhist, even, I guess, a little Christian, and some even thought that there was something Jewish in there. I don't know. It's an interesting kind of, sort of like the Baha'i or some of these fringe movements. So I don't think that Israel is planning an operation, but they certainly have plans in the when things get to the point where they actually have to engage. Right now, they're basically responding to anything that comes over the border. So if something gets shelled, if they get a rocket on their side, they send a bunch of rockets or artillery shells on the other side to try to at least warn people, stay away, we're watching. We'll see what happens. I mean, you look at the map, the southern front in Syria, which is ostensibly the southern front of the Free Syrian Army, or whatever group of rebels down there that calls themselves the Southern Front, has made gains in the southern part of Syria. And they're really close to the outskirts of Damascus. So we'll see where that goes. Hezbollah is, you know, right up on the mountains on the western side of Damascus. So that's really sort of the Syrian situation. I don't know exactly how that will work out. I suspect that Bashar Assad will try to hold out as long as possible and then flee Damascus as Damascus falls apart. I think we'll start to see that over the next few months. Probably 2016 might see the fall of Damascus itself, or at least its crumble. 2017 maybe finishing it off or something. I don't know.
Did you see any significance in the timing of what the most recent events with respect to the fall equinox, the occult, the Illuminati, you know, the papal visit here, all of this combined?
The blood moon, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, do you see any significance in that, or you know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, and of course, this sort of ties into what you were talking about in terms of those. The power, you know, the power behind the power. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm someone that, well, I spent most of my life thinking, yeah, all of this is just bad people doing bad things with greedy motives, and that was all it was. And that the fulfillment of prophecy would be merely just, I don't know, groups of evil people just doing what comes natural to them. But you know, over the last few years, when I sort of woke up, and last week's article that I wrote was kind of a part of that years ago awakening to, wait a second, there's a depth to this that isn't good. By the way, are we having some difficulty in terms of our sick? Okay.
I don't believe so.
I think the Skype had a glitch or two, you know, a half second once or twice since the show's been on, and it's been
okay
about 10 minutes, so we're good.
Okay, good. So, I mean, I remember the moment in time when, I remember the moment in time in which I sort of woke up to the glue that was holding everything together, and I think I've mentioned it before, but the idea that there is something that is holding all of this together. And I realized that it was a religion. And, you know, sort of like this Luciferian, Illuminati, everything, that there was a religion that was gluing the conspiracy together. And then, you know, of course, last week I wrote about the Jesuits. And the Jesuits are themselves a religion, and it's not exactly Catholic. And
yet people will, you know, as soon as you talk about the Jesuits, we begin talking about it, people will automatically say, oh, no, hey, you know, you're Catholic bashing, when in fact that's the last thing you're really doing. I mean, and I really would like you, it's your convenience, to talk about your column that you wrote, the Jesuits, the influence that they hold right now, especially having, well, Francis, the Pope, you know, in the papacy. I think it's significant. I think we need to talk about that.
Yeah, I think so too, because I think it is significant, first of all, that when the Pope arrived, first of all, I mean, he addressed the General Assembly on Friday, a week ago Friday. He is the first Jesuit Pope. He is the Pope that of a group of people, he's a representative of a group of people that everybody has feared, these Jesuits. They are the most effective intelligence organization in the world. Even the CIA says that. They know well, if there's any, if it's possible to know it, they know it. They are in. They have their fingers in everything. And so when I saw the Jesuit Pope get elected, get appointed, I just thought, wow, this is incredible. I mean, it is appropriate because we live in the last days. I mean, we're very close to the end, and here comes the Jesuit Pope. And it's hard to know exactly what they believe, but we have a lot of indications that what they believe isn't Christian, not even close. I mean, it appears to me that they worship Lucifer straight up, that there's no hedging about. I mean, they are by themselves a secret organization. They are a secret society. The hallmark of a secret society is that there are layers within the society, and that the bottommost layer does not understand what's going on at the top, and that as you move right through the organization, you get more and more of a revelation of what's going on within the organization until you reach the top and you realize that basically the top has been lying to the bottom. I mean, this is the Freemasons. The Freemasons have their 33 degrees, at least on the Scottish Rite, and every layer lies to the layer below until you reach the top and you realize what the truth is. Of course, by the time you reach the top, you are the lying liar at the top. You don't reach the top until you are, well, what the top wants you to be. Excuse me. So, I see that it's sort of like the Jesuits are the Catholic version of the Freemasons in one sense. Except in this way, well, they're a lot more directed, I believe, than what I would think the Freemasons are. I mean, the Freemasons, I don't know, I think they compete with each other. I think the conspiracy competes with each other. There are factions within, well, I think there are factions even within the Illuminati. We know that they regularly kill themselves off, kill each other off. But the Jesuits are monolithic. I mean, they don't appear to have factions within them. These guys are really powerful. And the person that started the Illuminati was a Jesuit.
Albert Pike.
No. Not the Illuminati. No, he didn't start the Illuminati. It was
Weishaupt?
Weishaupt. Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that was the time. I mean, they were the Jesuits were in Rock. Right. He was the head of, I guess, the seat of religion in Ingolstadt, Germany, the university there. And as I understand it, I mean, of course, again, we as regular people are trying to figure out what secret people, we're trying to understand the secrets of people that are trying to hide themselves. And in fact, they even lie to each other. I mean, so as people come out of these organizations and try to tell you what they think is the truth, even what they believe is probably a lie. So we're dealing with lie upon lie upon lie. And it's a little hard to figure out what the truth is. So we have to ultimately rely on the Bible. So as we look at all these things, we just realize, wait a second, all these people are doing is just pushing us towards whatever the Bible said is going to happen. So anyway, the Illuminati may themselves be a creation of the Jesuits. And when you sit there and go like, well, wait a second, why would the Jesuits create something that is so anti-God? Well, what have the Jesuits promised to do? They have promised to destroy anything that isn't Catholic. And one of the ways you do that is that you create factions within the opposition. You split and you fracture. You create fights among your enemies so that you become stronger. And that's what they're doing. So, and their goal is to destroy the Protestants. So that whatever is left, the Catholics can then, and again, like you said, we're not Catholic bashing. This is what the plans of the Jesuits are. In fact, if you just look at the Jesuit oath, that is itself horrifying. In fact, if you want, you want to read it, we could just read it quickly.
Yeah, please.
Okay, so this is there's a this actually comes from the website from it's called reformation.org, and it talks about the Jesuit oath. And there's a description at the beginning, and it says, when a Jesuit of minor rank is to be elevated to command, he is conducted into the chapel of the convent of the order, where there are only three others present, the principal or superior standing in front of the altar. On either side stands a monk, one of whom holds a banner of yellow and white, which are the papal colors, and the other a black banner with a dagger and red cross above a skull and crossbones, with the word INRI, I-N-R-I. And below them the words Iustum Necar Reges Impius, the meaning of which is, it is just to exterminate or annihilate impious or heretical kings, governments, or rulers. Upon the floor is a red cross at which the postulant or candidate kneels. The superior hands him a small black crucifix, which he takes in his left hand and presses it to his heart. And the superior at the same time presents to him a dagger, which he grasps by the handle and holds the point against his heart, the superior still holding it by the hilt, and thus addresses the postulant. So here's where you get the speech that the superior is said to the person who's actually asking to be elevated in rank. Now, part of the problem is, by the way, this INRI, which they said is, it is just to exterminate or annihilate impious or heretical kings, governments, or rulers. That is actually also the acronym for Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, or Iesus Nazarenos Rex Judeorum. Okay? So there is, by itself, right there, a blasphemy. But anyway, okay, so that's sort of the setting the scene. So here's the speech that the superior is given to the Jesuit that's about to be elevated to command. He says, "My son, heretofore, you have been taught to act the dissembler. Among Roman Catholics, to be a Roman Catholic, and to be a spy even among your own brethren, to believe no man, to trust no man. Among the Reformers, to be a Reformer. Among the Huguenots, to be a Huguenot. Among the Calvinists, to be a Calvinist. Among other Protestants, generally, to be a Protestant. And obtaining their confidence, to seek even to preach from their pulpits and to denounce with all the vehemence in your nature our holy religion and the Pope, and even to descend so low as to become a Jew among Jews, that you might be enabled to gather together all information for the benefit of your order as a faithful soldier of the Pope. You have been taught to insidiously plant the seeds of jealousy and hatred between communities, provinces, states that were at peace, and incite them to deeds of blood, involving them in war with each other, and to create revolutions and civil wars in countries that were independent and prosperous, cultivating the arts and the sciences, and enjoying the blessings of peace, to take sides with the combatants, and to act secretly with your brother Jesuit, who might be engaged on the other side, but openly opposed to that which you might be connected, only that the church might be the gainer in the end, in the conditions fixed in the treaties of in the conditions fixed in the treaties for peace, and that the end justifies the means. You have been taught your duty as a spy to gather all statistics, facts, and information in your power from every source, to ingratiate yourself into the confidence of the family circle of Protestants and heretics of every class and character, as well as that of the merchant, the banker, the lawyer, among the schools and universities and parliaments and legislatures, and the judiciaries and councils of state, and to be all things to all men for the Pope's sake, whose servants we are unto death." Now, I mean, that's the speech that describes what the lower order of the Jesuits is taught to be. Okay, so that's what they are, even at the lower level. And this is what the Pope was taught to be, the one that we are actually looking at now, Pope Frankie, by the way. Pope Frankie comes from John B. Wells. That was his name for him, and I like it. Anyway, now there's another paragraph, and then we have the oath. Mm-hmm. "I do further declare that I will help, assist, and advise all or any of His Holiness agents in any place wherever I shall be, in Switzerland, Germany, Holland, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, England, Ireland, or America, or in any other kingdom or territory I shall come to, and do my uttermost to extirpate the heretical Protestants or liberals' doctrines, and to destroy all their pretended powers, regal or otherwise. I further promise and declare that I will, when opportunity present, make and wage relentless war, secretly or openly, against all heretics, Protestants, and liberals, as I am directed to do, to extirpate and exterminate them from the face of the whole earth, and that I will spare neither age, sex, or condition, and that I will hang, waste, boil, flay, strangle, and bury alive these infamous heretics, rip up the stomachs and wombs of their women, and crush their infants' heads against the walls, in order to annihilate forever their execrable race, that when the same cannot be done openly, I will secretly use the poisoned cup, the strangulating cord, the steel of the poignard, or the leaden bullet, regardless of the honor, rank, dignity, or authority of the person or persons, whatever may be their condition in life, either public or private, as I at any time may be directed so to do by any agent of the Pope or superior of the Brotherhood of the Holy Faith of the Society of Jesus. I mean, there's a little bit more to that oath, but think about this Pope having made that oath, that vow. Think about that. I mean, this isn't something that you lightly engage in. Oh, yes, well, I have to give this vow if I'm going to move up in the ranks of the... No, this is serious. This is the Pope. So when you look at how wonderful or how great he seems, that's the Pope.
And towards the end, after a question and answer in the oath, it says, "He who will not accept him as the vicar of Jesus and his vice regent on earth, let him be accursed and exterminated."
Absolutely. Absolutely. Which means, basically, Joe, Doug, everybody listening, me, we've got a death sentence on us by the Pope. So that's kind of the idea of what we're looking at here. And so
explain that. I mean, one more time and a little bit further, a death sentence by the Pope. When you say that, and I'm sure people listening said, "What did he just say?" Do you say that? You know, why do you say that?
That's the Jesuit vow.
Okay, you know, you're tying it directly to that. Okay, I just want to make sure that people are clear on that. Okay.
Yeah. The other popes, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what kind of person they were. I mean, they might have been good people. I know that John Paul II seemed like a pretty good guy. But this pope is a Jesuit pope, which means that he has been indoctrinated, he has been taught, he has been required to be someone that seeks the death and destruction of everybody who does not owe allegiance to the Pope. I mean, that's the Jesuits. So you and I and all of us listening who are not Catholics, in the minds of every Jesuit, and it's not just most Jesuits or some Jesuits, it is every Jesuit, in the mind of every Jesuit, is that we should die. And I mean, seriously, guys, we don't really have any other choice of looking at this. After all, do you know who it was that was handed the, the Inquisition? The Jesuits. The Jesuits are, and by the way, the Inquisition never stopped. It is still there. They just changed the name. I can't remember the name of that they call the Inquisition now. But it is still administered by the Jesuits. Who had it before? It was I forget.
who had the Inquisition before?
Yeah, before the Jesuits. I don't remember. Anyway, they were pretty bad too. Okay, but
the Catholic Church, they in the medieval times murdered, tortured, mm-hmm. what they called heresy. They were a big force. You couldn't any type of progress, you know, and we're talking about reading, writing, the Bible, Scripture. You were not allowed to. They would put you to death and torture you for what they perceived to be heresy, and it wouldn't even be of sound doctrine. It would be of their doctrine.
Oh, that's right. I mean, if you didn't allow your children to be sprinkled by the local Catholic priest, off with your head, or whatever equivalent was. Now, let's take a step back, by the way. Go ahead.
I wanted to say this. You know, if people wonder, well, so what? You know, exactly how does this apply to present day or even, you know, remotely? Well, I just want to, real quick, and then I'm going to toss it back to you, but when I was looking at this, I was looking at potential examples, and look at Leon Panetta, who was chosen by Obama to be the director of the CIA, okay? Panetta was a Clinton bureaucrat. He wasn't in public office, you know, since 1997, 98, in that time frame. So what made Panetta very valuable to his superiors was his experience in a broad range of endeavors, and folks, his tie with the Jesuit community via Santa Clara University, which is the Jesuit, really the center of learning in the Silicon Valley. And Panetta was a congressman for 16 years as a Democrat. Now, he was a representative from California. He left a pretty key office. He chaired the House Committee on Budget and then went to become Clinton's 1993-94 director of the OMI, or OMB, that is, Office of Management and Budget. And from there, he went to become Bill Clinton's chief of staff from, it was, I think, 94 to 97 or 94 to 98 in that time period. And then, bang, all of a sudden, you know, he goes from obscurity post Bill Clinton to become Barack Obama's CIA director from 2009 to 2011. And then from there, he became Secretary of Defense. So one would ask the question, how could Panetta go from, well, the Office of Management and Budget, which is an accounting position, to leading one of the most strongest and feared, if you will, intelligence agencies and military in the world just in a matter of 10 years when he was not even in training, shall we say. Okay? And as I dug around into this, and by the way, Panetta was the Secretary of Defense on September 11th, 2012, when Benghazi took place and the run-up to Benghazi. So, you know, this is how, John, I mean, again, when I was looking for examples, I think this, I mean, this one jumped right out at me. Your thoughts on this?
Well, actually, this was news to me about Leon Panetta. But now that you mention it, you know, it kind of makes sense. But let me add sort of another wrinkle. Georgetown University. Who is it that runs that? It's not the Baptists.
Right. That's one of 28 Jesuit universities, right?
Yeah. I mean, right. Think of all the training, the justices and the judges and the lawyers and the politicians that have gone through Georgetown University. Now, by the way, and we should take a step back a little bit here. Even if, I mean, if you wanted to say, well, the Jesuits were started by Ignatius Loyola and he was a pretty good guy. Well, I'm not so sure he was a pretty good guy. But even if it was Saint Loyola, if we could all agree that he was just the one, most wonderful guy in the world, the fact is it was any hierarchical organization that has secrecy at its core is going to be corrupted. That is just, I mean, it's almost automatic. This is, I mean, even if you wanted to say, well, the Freemasons were started out as a great organization that wanted to do great and good deeds. Yes, it may possibly have been. Huh. Hello?
Mr. Little, we're up against the top of the hour break. Didn't even pay attention to the time. It just flew by. We'll be right back after these short messages. Stay with us. John Little is our guest on this Friday, October 2nd. We'll be right back.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.